Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra is taking on one of the great choral works of all time, Mozart's Requiem. Here to talk about it and more is Ward Stair, the RPO music director. Hello, Ward.
Hi, Julia. Nice to see you.
Nice to have you back in our studios. And in our studios for the very first time is tenor Anthony Dean Griffey, who is not only a brilliant tenor, but is also now on the faculty of the Eastman School of Music. Welcome to our studios, Anthony.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's spend a little bit of time talking about various things, but Ward, let's sort of spend a little time, if you don't mind, with the Hovhaniz and the Stravinsky, which begin this program. We begin the program with the Hovhaniz Prelude and Quadruple Fugue. He was kind of a master of counterpoint, and it really shows up here.
Yeah, well, he was actually one of the most prolific American composers in the 20th century, and of course, with the American music theme being a strong part of our 16-17 season, I was really thrilled to feature some of his music, and this actually has a good connection to Rochester as well, because it was written to celebrate, I think, the 25th anniversary of the American Music Festival, and is dedicated to Howard Hanson and the Eastman Rochester Symphony, which is what it was called at the time. Is written in 1955, and I liked it with the Mozart because of its fugal nature. There's a lot of great counterpoint in the Requiem, and it's not every day you get to hear a quadruple fugue.
That's a lot of fugue.
It is a lot of fugue. It's a beautiful sort of folksy melody in the prelude. You sort of can hear, I think, some of Hovhaniz's Scottish roots in the song and the lyricism of it. And then when the fugue gets going, it's beautifully written. You can easily identify the various subjects as they're introduced, and then the way they all fit together at the end is quite clever. It's about 6 minutes in total, and it's a great way to start off the evening.
You followed that up with a very difficult piece, and it's interesting knowing that you have just done the Shostakovich number 5. This week, you're going to do Stravinsky's Symphony in 3 Movements, where this is his first major work as an expatriate of Russia.
That's right, yeah, 1945, really, right at the end of the war, he wrote this piece, and it's part of his neoclassical period. I'm a huge Stravinsky fan all around, but this period in particular I really love, and the Symphony in C is right in there with the Symphony in 3 Movements. And it's interesting because it does have ties to the war in terms of his inspiration for it, but it's also interesting that it corresponds with the period in Stravinsky's life when he was flirting with Hollywood, you know, as a film composer. And so there's a lot of imagery that you can hear in the music because parts of it came from snippets of music he was working on for films that never, film projects that never actually came to fruition. And at the same time, as well, he was thinking about writing a piano concerto. So there's a lot going on in this piece. It's only about 22 minutes, and it's 3 movements. But you'll hear the piano featured quite prominently throughout, especially in the first movement. The harp also is very important in the second movement, and also in the third movement. And then the imagery is very interesting. The first movement, he said, he was envisioning actually the war in Asia and the Chinese landscape and people out there sort of digging around in the fields after the scorched earth kind of policy, and there was digging through ruins essentially. So it's a little bit rough, and you hear that expansive landscape, and I think you can sort of picture the vistas in the scene, which I guess he saw in some snippets of film, and that's how he was inspired. He was watching a lot of film while he wrote this piece because, as I said, he was trying to sort of get his foot in the door as a film composer in Hollywood. And the second movement is quite different in character. It's very, it's delicate, it's playful, it's casual, it's a little flirty. This also comes from a different film project where it was, I think, something about Bernadette was the name of the...
Song of Bernadette.
Yeah, the Song of Bernadette, that's right, was the film that this was supposed to be for. And I've read, you know, and it's well known that the apparition of the Virgin was supposed to be part of this night. But I have to say, that's kind of, listening to the second movement, I really don't know what the connection is there in terms of an apparition of a virgin. And I haven't seen the film, so I can't speak to that. But the character of the music is very vibrant. And as I said, it's coquettish, it's flirty, it's casual, it's relaxed, it's very lyrical. And it features the woodwind section, I think, very nicely. And then we go directly into the last movement through a brief interlude. It's about seven bars. It's just basically cadences, chord progressions that he takes us through. And the last movement is the most obviously, I think, connected to the military theme and the war. It begins with kind of a pompous military march, and similar to some of the music in Shostakovich Fifth last week, he actually, Stravinsky said that he envisioned the German army in this case, and, you know, goose-stepping and all these, you know, awful things. So it's overblown. It's very, like I said, it's pomposo. It's aggressive in places. You'll hear most of the symphony is, you know, very delicate, the neoclassical style, but the brass, especially the low brass and the percussion, do get to really dig in a little bit in this last movement, and that's kind of the more violent side of the war. And the imagery that Stravinsky's trying to create. But then as the third movement progresses, we gradually feel a change in the atmosphere, and it gets less about the aggression and the ugliness of the German army and more about the emerging allies and how they ultimately are victorious. And by the end, it's got tremendous energy, and you feel this bubbling up of, it's almost like the optimism welling up in America. And all over Europe too, as the Allies liberated, you know, city after city, and then Stravinsky himself sort of said, poked a little bit of fun at himself, I guess, in one of his few self-effacing moments, and said, "Yeah, that last harmony, that last chord, it's pretty indulgent. It's very Hollywood, but you know, hey, he had just moved to L.A., so it ends on a very bright, sunny note with a lot of fanfare, and it's a nice ride."
Why is this not programmed more often? Because it really does not show up.
It's a good question. I was told earlier this week that the last time the RPO did this was 40-some years ago, or 30 or 40 years. I mean, it's been a long time. Most of the musicians in our orchestra have not played this here. They may have played it somewhere else, but not in the RPO. And I think it should be on more programs. It's hard because of its length, I think. It's not long enough to sustain a second half on its own. And it's also difficult because it's hard. It's really, I mean, the orchestra has to really be on its game to play this piece well. So it demands a lot, and to put it in a secondary or tertiary place on a program with that much dedication required to prepare it adequately, I think is a tall order. But it shouldn't be any excuse. We certainly didn't use it as one this week, and I'm thrilled it's on the program.
Now, we wrap everything up with the big Requiem by Mozart. His Requiem was never finished. How many versions of this are there?
Oh, I have no idea, but many, many, many. I mean, there are at least four or five pretty well-known ones that I can think of that do get performed from time to time. But the one that you'll hear more often than not is the one we're performing this week, which is by Süssmayr.
Now, this is a work that is... Well, how much of it, let me go back, how much of what we're going to hear is Mozart's, and how much of what we're going to hear comes from the hands of Süssmayr?
Well, you know, I used to know the percentages by movements, or I have it written down on a piece of paper somewhere, but I would say, all told, it's maybe, for it, you know, in terms of the orchestration and everything, it's probably 35-40% Mozart, and the rest was Süssmayr, but that doesn't mean that Mozart didn't give us melodies. See, poor Süssmayr, I wouldn't want to have had this task, because a lot of the movements were left. Mozart would not even, in some cases, write the bass line. It was just the vocal line, and then it had to be filled in and realized.
And actually, he didn't even start the job. Eibler got the job first.
That's right, and he said, forget it, I can't, yeah.
He passed it back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so Süssmayr was kind of stuck.
Right, right. No, it was... I mean, talk about big shoes to fill, right? I mean, that would be, that's an unenviable task. But enough of it had been performed that, or enough of it had been finished that, you know, there was a desire and a demand for it. And actually, little snippets of it were performed at a service for Mozart right after he died. That was the first time that anyone ever sort of played it in public. but it wasn't complete at that point, far from it.
Anthony, one of the complaints that some of the noblemen and some of the church people had with Mozart back in the day was that his church writing was too operatic and his church writing was too dramatic. It didn't feel like it was sacred enough in its writing. How do you describe Mozart's solo lines and his vocal lines in these things?
My undergraduate is in church music and music ed, so I'm not sure if I would agree with that. And I grew up in the church, in the Baptist church.
I didn't say it. They said it.
They
back
said
then.
It. So, well, I'm saying.
And remember, we're also bracketing it in the era that it was.
Right. Right. So I find the solo lines for the soloist and for the chorus quite moving, and spiritual, and quite enjoy singing the piece. I've not had a long experience with the piece. The bulk of my repertoire in concert has been Mahler, Das Lied, Mahler 8th, the Beethoven Missa Solemnis. So it's such a joy for me to, this is my second outing with the Mozart Requiem, and my debut with the RPO. And 25 years ago, I sang on the stage of the Kodak Hall of the Eastman Theater when I was a student here. Back in the early 90s, and it's also my debut with Maestro Stair. So this is a highlight for me, and I'm quite excited about the whole experience. So for me, it's quite a spiritual journey, and we've got four wonderful soloists, dear friends that I've worked with before. All have Metropolitan Opera credits and have performed all over the world. The RPO sounds fantastic, and the beautiful thing about I've sung with orchestras all over the world, and there's a wonderful energy about the RPO that I've noticed over our last two nights of rehearsal. They're excited to play the piece, and Maestro Stair has a wonderful connection with the orchestra. They have respect for him. And I have several students who are singing in the chorus, and there's an excitement with the chorus, you know. And so all of this I say because, you know, this piece gets done a fair amount, but there's just a beauty about performing this, an excitement that I think the audience will definitely hear and see tomorrow night and on Saturday night.
There's a real mystique about this piece, about Mozart's Requiem. There's all kinds of information and misinformation and disinformation that was put out, especially by his widow, Constanza. She would say, for example, she was the one who started the story that that Mozart came to feel it was his own requiem,
right,
that he was writing, and so many other things. So throwing the mystique aside for a minute or two, what honest-to-goodness facts can you give us about the creation of this particular piece of music, Mozart's Requiem?
Well, okay, sticking to only facts, we can say that the way it's constructed, a lot of people have said that it's shorter because, you know, Süssmayr couldn't come up with enough of his own original material and Mozart didn't leave enough. But actually, we know, even though Süssmayr did the entire Benedictus, Mozart did leave out, like, if you look at the Verdi Requiem, you know, it's much longer, or, you know, Brahms' German Requiem. You know, there are other requiems that are longer, but it was the custom in Salzburg and Vienna at the time to do it in basically five sections, which is what he did. So the movements, it's pretty much complete in terms of the content. Now, we do know also, as of the 1960s, and this is one of my, just something that just blows my mind every single time I get to this moment in the piece, in the Lacrimosa. And now this is something that I like to share with people because it dispels some of the myths and that we all learned in the movie Amadeus, which is a fantastic movie and I love it. But right after, you know, Mozart actually did die in December, you know, and there was this scramble to sort of try to assemble the music and get it completed, and as you said, his widow was not helping things. But One person said, "Oh, well, this is this moment in the Lacrimosa after the first eight bars. This is where Mozart, you know, died right here. Boom, you know." So you get this amazing phrase in the beginning of the Lacrimosa, and the vocal line rises, and then we're meant to think that, oh, you know, that's the last music Mozart ever wrote. Well, never let the facts get in the way of a good story, right? That's actually not true. I think that he actually wrote up until the end of the Hostias, and if you listen to the way the piece is completed, Süssmayr ended up just repeating a lot of what Mozart had already written and changing the text slightly, which I think was an elegant solution to it, because he wanted to keep as much of it as Mozart's voice as he could. But back to the Lacrimosa for a second. This is this comes into play when you look at some of the other realizations and completions of the Requiem that have been done, notably by Robert Levin. He's done a very, very good one, I think. But there's a huge fugue at the end of the Lacrimosa. And if you don't know where that came from, you might think, why did he just decide to write a fugue? I mean, that's not there. It's just this plagal cadence, you know, in the end of the Lacrimosa. But that's not what Mozart intended. The reason he left off after those eight bars is because he was planning an enormous fugue at the end of the Lacrimosa on the word Amen. And the way we know that is, I've forgotten his name now, but it's a musicologist, well-known Mozart scholar in Germany in the 60s, I believe, came across a sketch of Mozart, just a piece of paper with a bunch of hand scratchings on it, and that's another myth that we can dispel that comes from Amadeus, that Mozart never, ever sketched. It's true he sketched far less than Beethoven, say, or other composers, but he did sketch every now and then.
There's some kind of comment about, by I think even Süssmayr, where he said he used the bits of papers.
Right, there were little bits, exactly. So Mozart did jot things down every now and then. And so this musicologist, whose name escapes me, I'm sorry, came across a huge, you know, sheet of manuscript paper, and it was said that it was Mozart's, and they sort of verified it was Mozart's handwriting. But the only thing that people could make out at a casual glance was the first two staves, which was clearly a little snippet from the overture to the Magic Flute. And there was some other scribbling underneath it, but it was so messy that no one could really tell, and no one had really taken the time. But this guy in the 60s was really determined to figure out what that was. And so after painstakingly trying to, you know, decipher what notes were on the page, he determined that it was in D minor. He thought, okay, well, we know we have Magic Flute at the top of the page, and this is in D minor. And he looked through Mozart's work, and he said, what else did he write in D minor in 1791? And bingo, the only other thing was the Requiem. And he thought, oh my God, this is from the Requiem. And then he looked closer, and he could barely make out in these under these four lines, it was staggered entrances, and I've seen a facsimile of it, actually, in one of the books that I read about the Requiem. It's fascinating. You can just barely, I mean, you have to work really hard, but you can see a little ah, and then about six bars later, and amen, and you can, and he finally, the light bulb went off, and he said, wow, this is a huge fugue, four-voice fugue, on the word Amen. And the reason Mozart stopped the Lacrimosa when he did was because he hadn't worked out the fugue yet, and he didn't know how he was going to get there to bridge that gap. So that's why he just, you know, abruptly stopped the Lacrimosa for a moment. He didn't know that he wasn't going to be able to finish it. But every time we get to that place in the piece, it always just, I can't help thinking about it, and oh God, what would this have been like if we had launched into this amazing fugue, you know, by Mozart on the word Amen. Oh, if only, you know.
If only, how many other amazing things would he have written?
Oh, I know.
Just getting started.
I know.
And to actually finish his life with this is fairly extraordinary. Costanza mm-hmm. really, she created a lot of historical chaos, though.
Oh, absolutely.
I must say. And this was followed up by several experts, there are the air quotes there, who mm-hmm. also kind of did not do this, but she needed the money.
Right.
In fact, this was actually delivered. She hid it. She had it finished in secret. Mm-hmm. She kept telling the man who, Count Valsec, that, yeah, it's on its way. And she lied. They forged his signature on the manuscript.
Right.
And they sent it back to him because she needed the money. So it's almost impossible to know what exactly was left behind, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, there's stories about Schikaneder being involved too, you know, his partner in crime for the Magic Flute, and actually Schikaneder apparently, the legend of the masked figure, the mysterious cloaked figure that you see in Amadeus, That story actually emerged in the 1820s, I think, in Germany. And it was told supposedly by someone who, you know, it's like my friend's friend's brother's neighbor's cousin, you know, a man who met the daughter and then ended up meeting the father, who claimed to be the young boy who was sent, you know, in disguise by Schikaneder to play a practical joke on Mozart. So, I mean, it gets so convoluted, and we never know 100%, you know, what really was going on around the composition of this piece, because it's been so overly, you know, dramatized and fictionalized and romanticized and everything.
How much Mozart have you sung, Anthony? Do you tend to sing Mozart?
Yes, I sang Idomeneo with the title role with the Mostly Mozart Festival. I was involved in Magic Flute at the Metropolitan Opera. I've not done a great deal of Mozart, but I have a great deal of respect and love. I've done Don Ottavio. I never sang Tamino, though I always wanted to sing Tamino, but because of my size, I am a large man, as you can see. You know, people have a certain look they want for Tamino. So the bulk of my career was playing outsiders. Peter Grimes, I've sung all over the world,
Amazing
including
Grimes.
The Met and Lenny of Carlisle Floyd's of In Mice and Men.
But going back to the Mozart, my question being, how different is Mozart when you're in the opera house versus when you're singing something sacred?
Well, I view Mozart as a sacred composer. So I think that there's humor in Mozart. I think he was definitely a living, breathing soul. I think that he was a very clean composer. I think that, but that people also, singers especially, when they go to Mozart, they go to it rather timidly. And that's not the way I approach Mozart. I sing Mozart with my voice, which is, some would say, a more substantial size voice. But I don't think of it as walking a tightrope.
Is his church music, things like his many masses, the Requiem, are they significantly different for a singer than something that he writes for opera? Or does his Requiem stand almost operatically as well?
I think his Requiem stands operatically, to me. I think the choruses are definitely operatic. I think the soloists are operatic. And in opera, you have both, you know, dramatic singing and soft singing, and extroverted singing and introverted singing. And as soloists, we play off of each other. You know, in the ensembles, where we're ensemble members, but we also deliver these very dramatic lines and take on characters. So I think that's what brings Requiem's, Oratorio's concert work off the page.
You teach at the Eastman School of Music, and you say, you know, people often approach Mozart timidly, which you do not. So I assume at some point you're going to be, if you're not already, working with your students in your studio at the Eastman on Mozart. So what are you telling them when you hand them a Mozart piece of music and say, you're going to sing this? What do you tell them?
Already I've given out Mozart. Mozart's not easy to sing only because people are afraid of it. The first piece of aria that I was ever given was Dalla Sua Pace, at a very young age as an undergrad. And I was very afraid of it because it was quite exposed. But I was, you know, feeling like I was walking a tightrope. And it wasn't until I got to Eastman as a grad student and I sang it on a master class that a teacher let me free myself and bring to Don Ottavio what I felt like, you know, should be brought to the role. That he was a virile man and not, you know, a weak person. And it's important to sing, you know, I think everyone, every healthy voice should be able to sing Mozart. It's an important part of a singer's repertoire. I have them sing it with their voice, which is important. Because when I first give it to them, of course, they kind of tiptoe on around it and like they're on eggshells. But that's not the way to approach it.
This is actually something I hear from the musician side of things, too, the instrumental side of things, that a lot of instrumentalists are a little unnerved, shall we say, by Mozart, a little fearful of it because of this very thing that Anthony mentions, the exposure that the musicians get when they play it.
Well, it's so, first of all, it's good for all of us to do Mozart. It's good for orchestras to play Mozart. It's good for singers to sing Mozart. And I mean, and not be afraid of it, exactly as Anthony's saying. I mean, it's absolutely right. But the thing about Mozart, I think, that gives people that anxiety is the fact that it's so elegantly written, it's so beautifully constructed, that there really is no fluff to hide behind in Mozart. Everything is important. You know, that's one thing that we can take away from Amadeus that's true. Remember when Salieri is admiring his music and saying there's not a single, you know, misplace one phrase and the structure will fall. I forget the exact line, but It's very true. So it requires a lot of dedication. It requires a lot of discipline, but not a punitive, you know, restrictive discipline. Just, you know, you really have to be focused and you have to be just, you know, like a laser beam sometimes with precision in order to let it really shimmer and shine. And I also think that, you know, Mozart is like Beethoven in the sense that it's a household name, you know, with Haydn. So everybody, there's this expectation when you play Mozart. But and you know, I'm an enormous Beethoven fan. I mean, so I'm nothing against Beethoven at all. But I think it's easier to get away with playing a Beethoven symphony from an orchestral perspective and make a little error here or there to get away with it in the audience's ears and, you know, eyes than it is when you do Mozart.
In fact, I have seen on more than one occasion soloists who have come in to play a Mozart piano concerto with the RPO. Mm-hmm. They have done a magnificent job, just beautiful, sparkling, and facile. And the people don't stand. And it's almost as if the audience doesn't get how very hard that was, giving that kind of clarity.
Yes, and elegance and subtlety and beauty and you know, structure. Structure is very important, too. I mean, we're talking the high classical period here, so everything, you know, it's got a very precise way that it's put together, and I think to really highlight that is to do it justice, but it's no mean feat.
Anthony, where do you start your students at the Eastman School of Music with Mozart?
Mozart wrote a lot of beautiful Lieder as well. And so I start them around sophomore year. I don't assign Mozart arias early on until they can sing songs well. I think it's important to be able to sing songs and Lieder well before you venture into arias. Of course, you know, they want to start out singing arias, a lot of them. But I think that if you learn to sing art song well, because art song are really mini operas, if you learn to sing song well, then you can sing opera well. And if you sing, you know, song well, then you should be able to sing concert work really well. Because what brings concert work works to life is bringing these characters to life, and realizing that they're, you know, really unstaged operas. And some of them I've done Elijah where I actually did it staged with Seiji Ozawa in Japan and in Italy. So the drama is still there with these wonderful concert pieces.
The two of you have something more than just the performance of Mozart's Requiem that's going to happen. You both have something in common in that you were here in Rochester as students, and you have returned to Rochester as leaders, as teachers, as somebody at the at the front of the orchestra, as opposed to in the back when you first arrived here. Tell me about what that feels like when you came back to Rochester Ward and you were no longer the kid in the pit or the kid in the RPYO, but in fact, you were never a soloist with the RPYO. You just became the music director.
Well, I, you know, it's been, it's been 3 years now, and I still every now and then have to just take a step back and realize, you know, how extraordinary it is to come back and now be the music director of the first orchestra that I ever heard live in the city, which gave me so much as a young person growing up. And it's very special. I mean, no matter where I am, if I'm putting on a concert, making music, it's always special because I love making music. But there's something, there's an added level of meaning to it, I think, when it's your hometown and you know, an orchestra that was so important in my life, in my development, and a city that's been so important to me at various stages of my life and career now. It does create a certain depth and an extra special meaning to it for me, absolutely.
Do you ever want to say, I'm a fraud? No, really, I'm a fraud. I mean, when you stand in front of your classroom, Anthony, probably one of the very rooms that you actually studied in a few years ago, do you ever want to just look at the kids and go, no, just kidding?
Yeah, well, I grew up in North Carolina. I have a hand of Southern accent, you may have heard.
Kind of caught that.
So I went to a really small undergrad school, Wingate University. And so I'm from High Point, North Carolina, which is the furniture capital of the world. So both of my parents were furniture factory workers. So my father was illiterate. My mother had limited education. So classical music was new to me. My organist at my church gave me free piano lessons. And I was a boy soprano, and she would go every Christmas to New York City and to St. Thomas and write down all these boys' descants and then bring them back home to me. And I was extremely shy, and I'd walk down the aisle of the church and with my, you know, hands covering my eyes and sing these descants. And so I thought, you know, that my chosen career would be that of a minister of music. So Eastman was introduced to me. I won a competition called the National Association of Teachers of Singing, and one of the judges was from Eastman, the late Marsha Baldwin. She heard me and said, I think you should audition for Eastman, and I thought, you know, I'll never get into Eastman. I did get into Eastman and didn't have the money to come here to visit, so I just landed in Rochester, and it was like, you know, the big city for me. So my classmates back in the 90s called me country come to town. I had plaid shirts on and blue jeans and was just thrilled to be here and learned a lot. My first big opportunity to sing solo was the tenor solos in Elijah with Donald Newen, who was the choral director here. And so I was the tenor soloist for Elijah, and the next day the newspaper read tenor soloist Tony Griffey shines in Elijah Ortorio. So that kind of launched it, and Renee Fleming came and gave a master class, and the late Rita Shane, I worked with her briefly here, and she said, you know, you really should go to New York City and pursue this. And I thought, you know, I don't have the money. I helped my family back in North Carolina. So I took their advice. I went to sing for Beverly Johnson, who was a teacher at Juilliard. And I met Mrs. Johnson when she was 87. And she said, you have a hell of a lot of talent and a hell of a lot to learn. So then I went back to school at Juilliard after Eastman for 2 years, and then was accepted into the Metropolitan Opera Young Artist Program. So it was a journey that I'd never, you know, and then to come full circle after a 25-year performing career and still performing, to come back to Eastman to teach. And I realize as part of, I view myself as a different type of minister now. So, you know, I'm still a minister, but in a different type of way.
One of the things that I hear a lot about the Eastman over and over again is that as music schools, it's the most humane in the country. It's the one where there will be most caring, the least amount of competition, and certainly the most amount of really buttressing up one's talent and bringing somebody forth. So how do you now, looking back, do you see that? And now, of course, you're part of that. So how do you continue that, Anthony?
Well, I think as a teacher, you know, it was a very nurturing environment while I was here. And I try to carry on that tradition and to guide students. Singers are very delicate because we carry our instrument 24/7. And it's very difficult for some singers to realize that they're also a human being, not just a voice. So that's something that I try to instill in my students and also to keep their individuality. You know, we had the great singers of the past, Pavarotti and Joan Sutherland and Anna Moffo and Buehrling and these wonderful singers. So, you know, it's important for them to be the next best self that they are. So that's something that I try to instill and something that was instilled in me is that, you know, to be the best Tony Griffey that I could be and not try to be a carbon copy of someone else. And that's the advice that I try to give my students and develop and helping them develop a really solid technique and also to be themselves and to realize that even at a young age, they have something to offer this world.
Ward, when we go and listen and see this Anthony and friends, including Catherine Lewick, a former winner of the Classical Idol here and another Eastman grad, when we go to see and hear the Mozart Requiem, what do you want us to walk away with?
Oh, boy. That's, I think... a sense of deep satisfaction, I guess. I mean, by the time it's finished, you know, you go on quite a journey throughout the piece from the sort of mysterious opening, the powerful initial statement from the chorus. I think the passages for the solo vocalists are quite beautiful, especially, I really love the Recordare. I mean, that's mm-hmm. so beautiful. I mean, it's all very beautiful, and I have to say it's... you know, Tony and I have known each other for some years now, but this is the first time we've actually had an opportunity to work together, and I'm really, really thrilled. I mean, it's great to work with such amazing vocalists. It's really luxury casting, I have to say, this week. They all sound fantastic, and the chorus sounds wonderful, as does the orchestra. So, you know, when you come together to do a piece like the Mozart Requiem, it's really, you know, it's a part of your life for that week, and, you know, we want to invite all of our audience members in to have that amazing experience into Mozart's world, his last, his last accomplishment, even though he didn't get to finish it. You know, it's definitely his voice, and, you know, I think it'll leave you in a satisfied and maybe thoughtful place.
I want you both for being so thoughtful here today. I appreciate it deeply. Our guests today are Ward Stair, the music director of the RPO, and Anthony Dean Griffey from the Eastman School of Music, first as a student, now as a professor, and certainly as a worldwide soloist. It's been great to have you here. If you'd like information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.